Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. It is Monday morning, the 18th of June. The sun is rising and that tomb is still empty, and that is good news indeed. For because our Savior lives, there is always hope and always future in the beautiful kingdom of Jesus. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings this morning. I'm your host, your interim host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio this morning, running the board by Matt Reynolds, and he is substituting for Logan Roush, who is off for the first 3 days this week. Apparently, Logan had more than enough in terms of time in studio with me last week. Needs a little break, a little breather. Glad to have Matt in studio. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
We got show producer Paul Perreault in the newsroom, and he is going to take us through some of the headlines and traffic and weather this morning. Grateful to have him and Rachel Sutton in this team for booking the great guests that we see each morning as part of this morning show. Solid first hour ahead around 6:40. We will talk through the headlines of the day with regular guest and political and constitutional expert Dr. Adam Carrington. Help us think through some of the daily news, including probably what many of you saw this weekend, some of the immigration headlines where families are being separated at the border, and how we sort of talk through the sticky moral and legal dimensions of this. And coming up in a few minutes, just after the break, we're going to play an interview that the venerable Neil Stavem had with Jonathan McKee, and it's all about kids and social media and mobile devices. I'm excited for this interview. I've got 5 kids at home, and this phone stuff and this mobile stuff is always relevant. I don't really know how to navigate this stuff. And Matt, we are talking at break, too. A pretty relevant interview for you.
Yeah, we've got 11, 9, 6, and 4, so we're heading into the age of how to let them use the internet, but trying to protect them at the same time.
Yeah, you were talking, you don't even have an internet filter to use that would be effective for this.
Right, and the one that you always heard about was Covenant Eyes, and I believe they just shut down like at the end of last month.
So we're down one more of these filters, and I find that if you really want to get around these things, they don't always block what you would want them to block. We kind of test them out when we use them, and so what would be effective for protecting our kids, I think, is a really important conversation.
Yeah, and I mean, Google's great. I mean, everybody uses Google and Wikipedia for pretty much everything nowadays. But I mean, you type in one thing with the wrong letter, wrong word, or an innocent question saying, you know, picture of something, you never know what's going to pop up.
Yeah, it brings in this rabbit hole sort of thing, and you can become Alice really quickly and dive down into these things. So Jonathan McKee, you won't want to miss this interview with Neil Stavem. Just help protect our young people and their use within media. That'll be coming up here right after the break. Great to have you with us here this morning. We'll head to break and listen into that conversation on the internet.
On the morning show right now, Jonathan McKee. Jonathan has authored some 20-plus books, including The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices, 21 Tips to Wise Posting in an Insecure World. He's been involved in youth ministry for a couple of decades, speaks to parents and leaders worldwide, and blogs regularly. In fact, on your blog here just the other day, Jonathan, you wrote about Tim Cook talking to Apple shareholders a little bit about concerns about addiction to our devices, and that was one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you today. So even the inventor of it is concerned that we've maybe gone too far.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of cool when you see tech companies who, you know, I mean, come on, we've all heard the stories about these evil tech companies sitting around their cauldrons, you know, coming up with evil ideas of how to, get our kids addicted to their devices and apps. But, you know, it looks like, well, finally, eventually, they're seeming to actually care about what's going on, because both Google and Apple last month, in the month of May, actually have come up with some things saying, okay, you know what? Maybe we need to help people manage their time a little bit, track usage, you know, limit the phone's ability to distract. So Google stepped up and did that and has some ideas on how to do that, to put some limits, some things like actually like when you set your phone down, face down, it would actually go into like a do not disturb mode. You could do different things like that. So, and Apple announced that they're going to do something. They announced these digital health initiatives, and they haven't gone into specifics, but it's kind of cool because for the last couple of years, so many parents have been concerned, and there's kind of been a slow, hey, wait a second, maybe we shouldn't be just handing our kids phones. And I think maybe that voice is finally being heard.
That's, I know, something that you've been talking about for a long time. And I know that you're not somebody who says no technology, no devices whatsoever, but you do offer us some guidelines, and that's what we wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, with young people today, it's tough. I mean, we live in a world where the average young person gets a smartphone at 10.3 years old. So this is tough for parents, you know, who are trying to, you know, show some good wisdom and teach our kids, you know, good discernment. We're hearing from experts out there, people like Gene Twenge, who wrote the book iGen. So many different experts out there saying, hey, wait, not deny your kids social media, but delay social media. And that's kind of the voice that I've had for quite a while, looking at a lot of these studies, looking at many of these experts. Common Sense Media, their CEO and founder, he said he didn't give his kids phones till high school. Bill Gates didn't give his kids the phones till they were 14 years old and then high school. So that's kind of my message to parents all the time. It's not that we're going to deny them of this stuff, but that we're going to not rush to give it to them because, I mean, it is tough. Our kids come home and they're like, all my friends have phones, you know, every single one of them, you know, and that's where my kids always, I drove them nuts because I was like, actually, 78.6% of your friends have phones. And they're like, Dad, don't give me stats right now, you know. but it is interesting. We have over 3/4 of 12 through 17-year-olds who have smartphones right now. And those that don't, a lot of them have access to devices. I mean, it's up in the 90% style of how many kids are on social media. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a world where young people are on it. Those parents that are saying no social media, a lot of those kids are sneaking or just, you know, hey, let me see your phone at school with their friends. And so parents need to teach their kids discernment on this and teach them how to be wise. And so that's why I talk with young people about this all the time. I talk with them about wise posting in such an insecure world.
We'll maybe get some specifics on that in a moment. But so we delay as one strategy, but here the summer school's out now, so we don't want our kids just sitting in front of screens all summer long. What would be some framework guidelines to help us talk through limited usage?
Yeah, no, that's a good question because, I mean, one of the big questions I'm getting right now from parents is, hey, my kids just want to sit and play Fortnite all day long. It's, you know, this is a popular video game and it comes on so many different screens. And, you know, if we don't monitor our kids, some of them will literally just sit on their hindsides, you know, the entire summer just and never even go outside. So most media experts out there are saying set limits. What those limits are, you know, a lot of people disagree on. But, for example, the American Academy of Pediatrics looks at, you know, young people who are averaging 9 hours of entertainment media per day, 6 hours of that is screen time because some of it's listening to music and stuff that's not screens. And they're saying, hey, you should limit to 1 or 2 hours a day of screen time. Now, think about that. That's in a way that almost sounds crazy because, you know, I mean, kids average 6 hours and to say, sorry, 1 hour, you know, so it's up to parents to figure out what that looks like. For sure, I think that, you know, parents could sit there and go, you know, look at each kid individually because for some kids, maybe video games is the thing, you know, and for that video gamer, I think this is a great opportunity to say, hey, you know, you're, you know, whatever your limit is, an hour or 2 hours a day or whatever, I think parents should jump in on that and think, hey, here's an opportunity for me to bond with my kid and maybe jump in and say, well, it's an hour a day unless I'm playing with you, you know, and all of a sudden you could throw something like that. You could extend their limit if you get to play with them. Well, now, guess what? All of a sudden, kids can be very motivated to have you sit next to them, and now you can have some great bonding time with your kid. So look for opportunities. Whatever that limit is that you should have, you should definitely have a limit. That's what experts say. Whatever that limit is, you know, maybe use that as an opportunity to connect with your kids and then come up with fun ideas of stuff to do with your kids. Don't just be like, figure it out. Go outside. You know, come back in when the when the streetlights come on. You know, that's what I did when I was a kid, you know. You know, maybe we can have some ideas of what to do with them. You know, that's why I wrote the book, 52 Ways to Connect with Your Smartphone-Obsessed Kid. Tons of ideas in there of what to do.
I assume maybe on special occasions like, you know, vacations or, you know, road trips or those kinds of things, we can have some maybe adjusted guidelines there too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wrote this article recently on our webpage, thesourceforparents.com. That's thesource4parents.com, about our kids with headphones, because that's another phenomenon where parents are going nuts because their kids are always walking around us with headphones on. And it was funny, you know, I didn't want to have yet another rule of no headphones in the house. So, like, for me, I was thinking, well, you know, on trips – you know, you're on a 7-hour car ride, it's kind of hard to say no headphones. So I did some things on trips to try to make it more fun. Like I'd say, hey, let's each of us make a playlist and we'll listen to each other's playlist. And that's kind of a fun thing because then they get excited about, you know, getting a playlist and the whole family listening to it, you know. But then we let them have their headphones on trips like that. But around the house, one thing I did is I went up to Costco, actually, and bought for each of my kids, I bought them kind of this giant docking station boom box. You know, it's this huge set of speakers at the docking station. And I came home, I'm like, guess what, kids? I got you all an early Christmas present. Here you go. And they were so excited to get, oh, my gosh, look at this thing. You know, and it would charge their phone and play their music nice and loud in their room. And as I basically bought their happiness there real quick, as they're running upstairs with their brand-new boom boxes, I was like, oh, and by the way, you know what? Since you got those, you know, let's not do any headphones in the, you know, house. Let's just play those as loud as you want in your room anytime. And they were kind of like, sure. And they didn't even think of it as like a no headphones rule. It was just me saying, hey, use these instead. And some of my friends were like, Jonathan, you're telling your kids to play music as loud as they want in the room? I tell you what, I always knew what my kids were playing. I always knew what music was being played. I was able to kind of keep an ear on it, and I didn't have these kids isolating themselves, listen to Post Malone on their headphones. That's not really good music, by the way. So, you know, yeah, it's just we got to be creative in how we can create these ways to keep the conversations open about the entertainment media they're soaking in and not being so rule-based that all we're doing is limiting. But it's good to have limits. The question is, how are you going to do those?
Let's talk some more with Jonathan McKee in a moment. Jonathan has been in the youth ministry, speaks to parents and leaders worldwide. You can read more about him, find out some of his blogs, and, of course, he's written some 20 books. TheSource4Parents.com is his website, TheSource4Parents.com. Jonathan McKee, my guest today. We're going to talk about the Teen's Guide to Social Media and more coming up in just a moment here on The Morning Show. Jonathan McKee's with us today in the morning show. Jonathan's a best-selling author and he's a speaker, provides encouragement to parents, especially with the young people still in the house, and written a number of books like The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices, The Guy's Guide to God, Girls, and The Phone in Your Pocket, and 52 Ways that You Can Connect with Your Smartphone-Obsessed Kid. And we've been mentioning some guidelines for the summer, but using social media, Jonathan, that it seems like our kids are really hooked on that, that that's the only way that they experience life at all. And it is a little disconcerting because it's not always a safe and happy place.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough world out there. There's some people out there that are targeting our kids, and we don't want to lock our kids in a dungeon and say, you can never look at a screen in your life. But, you know, it's good to have some conversations with our kids to help them realize, hey, who's peeking at you? Who's looking at you? And so when it comes to social media, you know, we talked before the break about, you know, some healthy limits so they're not just sitting in front of a screen all the time. But then when it comes to when they are on their screen, what are they doing on that screen? That's the reason why I wrote The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices. It's kind of a fun book that goes through with humor and with good stories, talk with them about some of these decisions on what it's like to post wisely in such an insecure world. And you know, whenever I talk with teenagers about this, you have to be shrewd when you talk with teenagers. You can't just be like, okay, teenagers, let's talk about your privacy settings, you know, so that you're safe. Kids will be like, you know, I mean, they don't even listen. So, like, when I'm at school assemblies and I'm talking to young people about this, I use stories, and I'll constantly use stories to talk about this. Like, for example, if I want so many young girls are not really careful about whether they post their locations or who they're friending, and they think they're friending this cute guy at a school down the street, but they don't realize they're friending a 45-year-old pedophile who's sitting in his basement stalking, you know, young girls. So one way I kind of, you know, help them understand that a little bit is by telling them stories. Like, I'll tell them the story of creepy underwear guy. That's a story I use in school assembly all the time. It's this true story of this guy that the cops caught, and he basically used to stalk young girls and try to befriend them using posing under different identities. He would go on Facebook and he'd wait till girls checked in at the local mall. He would do whatever he could to find girls who posted their locations. And the creepy part was, so often he was able to find pictures they had posted from home. So he would, in the middle of the night, sneak into their houses. He would choose which girls he wanted to. He would sneak in their houses, and he would steal their underwear. When the cops actually caught him, they were able to identify him because he had underwear from all these different girls' houses. Now, the funny thing is, when I tell that story at a school assembly, you can see girls starting to pull out their phone and starting to scroll through their Instagram posts, and they're looking for, wait, did I post my location? Did I, you know? And I don't even have to say, hey, be careful posting your location. All I got to do is tell them about creepy underwear guy, and they're like, oh my gosh, you know. So we need to just talk with kids about this, and that's where this book comes in handy, because I get a whole chapter on who's peeking at you, and it's cool because you can even say to your daughter during the summer, hey, read this and let's go to breakfast. Let's talk about it. We need to engage our kids in conversations about this, so when they are spending time on screens, they're thinking carefully about who they're connecting with, what they're posting.
John, we've got just a couple minutes left. I'm just curious on the younger generation. It seems much more certainly bathed in the secular worldview, and lots of conversations about our kids hanging on to the faith or walking away from it. Is social media playing a part of that, do you think?
Well, here's the difference. I mean, just 5 or 6 years ago, you know, the overwhelming majority of America did not have smartphones in their pockets. And now young people are walking around with not only their entire entertainment media library, but social media mobily, where they used to have to actually kind of, you know, sit in front of a screen plugged into a wall. And this access to social media mobily, in the last 5 years, we've seen an unprecedented rise in teen anxiety, teen depression, teen suicide, and every expert out there is pointing towards social media. And it's kind of a no-brainer, because think about it. Right now, young people are carrying around this little barometer of how well-liked they are, you know, how many friends they have, you know. Hey, how many friends do you have? Just a sec, let me check today. Okay, here's how many friends I have, you know. How well-liked are you? Well, let me see how this last posted. Not real liked right now, you know. At least not as liked as that guy, you know. And we've got – I was just talking about this on the TV show, and the girl who was doing my makeup said, oh, my gosh, I was just hearing what you said, and it's so true. My 10-year-old nephew is on Instagram, and his goal in life is to become an Instagram celebrity. So – we definitely, in the last 5 years, have kind of really put the pressure on young people's identity by dangling in front of them all these, you know, kind of role models where the goal in life is to how many followers you have and this and that. So, yeah, it's affecting young people big time, not to mention that they're following celebs. And the celebs have such influence to where a lot of young people, it's kind of like, well, Kim Kardashian says, you know, or Kylie Jenner says, you know. And so these are becoming the role models for young people today. So moms and dads need to really have dialogues about what they're soaking in, for sure, because it's affecting them, the way they think, their methodology, their ideology, their theology.
Well, let me recommend the writing and the speaking of Jonathan McKee. You can find him and all his resources at the website, thesourceforparents.com. That's the number four, thesourceforparents.com. Jonathan has written some 20 books. He's been speaking in the ministering to youth and parents and leaders worldwide for a couple decades. And Jonathan, we always love having the opportunity to connect with you and appreciate the wisdom that you share, and look forward to catching you again down the road.
Hey, my pleasure. I'm glad we were able to have the conversation, and I hope that parents keep up the conversation.
Great conversation with Neil Stavem and Jonathan McKee this morning. Matt and I were just talking here in studio. We have 9 kids between us trying to figure out how to navigate all of this social media and internet world. And actually, as listeners, if you have any suggestions for good and effective internet filters, I know the two of us would welcome those this morning. Let's take a break. We'll head to Lighten Up, kind of chuckle through our way through the morning, come back for the news, and head to the second half of our show. Got a few birthdays in the news this morning here, kind of dominated by the music scene. We've got Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Paul McCartney is 76 years old. We have country music singer Blake Shelton is now 42. You might see him on The Voice. And, of course, we have musician Dizzy Reed, 55 years old. He's the keyboard player for Guns N' Roses. I know Matt was talking about what a GNR guy he is here. Let's head to news. We'll come back. And second half of our hour, we'll be joined by Adam Carrington. Talk all things politics. We hear from Sandra Crawford Williamson, author, speaker, and consultant, and she's going to be enlightening us today about working women in the church and how the church can help the working women in our lives.
The workforce is made up of 52% women, and 70% of moms in America are working outside the home in some capacity, and 75% of them full-time. And so the church is filled with us. But we don't really know. I call it the camouflage woman. We don't really know who each other are at church. And so I still some days feel lonely at church and like there's not a group for me. My husband's great. He's very dialed in at church, and we do couple things. But in terms of the life I'm leading Monday through Friday, you know, I say my mission field is business. I want to have a small group to talk about that stuff and be really authentic with. So I often say if mama gets up on Sunday morning and would rather make chocolate chip pancakes for everybody and keep them in their pajamas, then they're not going to go to church. And guess what? The family and their tithing walk away. And so I'm just very passionate about this topic and want to try and raise awareness of things that churches and other women and anyone can really do to make them feel more welcome.
That's Sandra Crawford Williamson. And if you want to hear that entire segment, head to myfaithradio.com. You can search Professional Women of Faith or Williamson and check out our entire segment. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be back with Adam Carrington.
When biblical values don't matter, things get ugly. This is Jim Garlow. Democracy cannot function long-term without biblical values of honesty, integrity, and loyalty. It's key to understanding massive corruption in business, in government, in all aspects of community and public life. Historically, America's values have been Christian and biblical values. You don't rip people off. You don't lie. You don't steal. And if you do, you admit it as sin. You repent. You pay the price for wrongdoing. Honesty, integrity, loyalty. Whether America succeeds or fails depends on the extent to which we embrace these biblical Christian values. There's no getting around it. Some would say you can't fully appreciate something until you've lost it. I hope that's not true. Now is the time to preserve what we have. Now is the time to pray for God's blessing, to embrace biblical values. This is Jim Garlow.
Just about 23 minutes before the top of the hour, and that is the walk-up music of Adam Carrington, Dr. Adam Carrington, who is assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College and a regular contributor to The Morning Show to help us sort of sort through all of these difficult headlines of the day. I am Dr. Peter Kapsner, and you're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. And Adam, I understand you were actually traveling this last week. You were sending us news headlines from some border town of Kentucky and Tennessee on your way to Michigan. You're just staying updated on the news here as you're doing a roadie. Is that the deal?
Well, the radio helps. And yes, I was at a rest stop. We were trying to calm down our one-year-old who wasn't loving driving partway across the country. And so we had just crossed the Tennessee into Kentucky border when I sent one of my emails to you all, which you all were very gracious to take.
Well, I can sympathize. We've been across those country trips with our young kids too, and I look for those rest stops, but then I don't really actually know what to do when we get there. It just feels good to stop, right?
Exactly. And it was a great vacation that we were on, but
and the baby loved it except for that trip, and that made the drive back quite they're called rest stops. I don't think we did much resting when we stopped.
Well, lots to cover out here this morning, you know, any number of topics. Obviously, some of the top-of-the-mind stuff from the weekend is sort of this blowing-up immigration conversation where you have these pictures of families being ripped apart at the border, and you have sort of on one side people advocating for the rule of law. We have to be able to apply the law here. And other people are talking about compassion and that we need to think about how we're applying the law. Can you kind of walk us through, Adam, what we're seeing and how to understand some of this?
Sure, and part of the problem is there's a lot of confusion about exactly what's going on because there's so many moving parts. What's basically happening is the Trump administration has stepped up not just deporting people who cross the border illegally, but prosecuting them for doing so as a crime. And basically, without getting into all the legal statutes that come into play there, that results in, if you come with children, that you will be separated from those children. And by them stepping up that process, more and more families that are trying to cross together have been separated. And obviously, that's a really difficult policy. And I think you see that the difficulty the administration's having with it because in two things. One, you see them making different officials making different arguments. Nielsen, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, just said, well, there is no policy of separation. President Trump has said that there is one, but it's the Democrats' fault for legislation they had passed. And then you have, you know, Stephen Miller, an advisor to the president, and Attorney General Sessions both saying, no, it's our policy, and we did it to deter immigration. And I think all those different things show that the administration's having a little trouble defending it, but underneath it is an attempt to – I think it's a legitimate worry of how do you secure the border, but I think the outcry is showing that there's a major question of is this the way to do it, or is there some other way to achieve the same result with less something less visceral as separating children from their parents.
And it sounds like there's on one side of the equation – that there may be sort of this intentional flooding of the border to be able to distract and divert from allowing some of the cartels to come across the border with some drugs or whatever else on one side. But on the other side, you have the legitimate humanitarian and hospitality of welcoming people in need. Is there a way to sort out really what's happening here at the border, or is it a complex combination of these factors?
Yes. I mean, one thing I think the administration has not been consistent in how their different officials have explained the policy, because I think one thing you're pointing to is a very good thing I think they're doing, which is trying to find where drug smugglers or sex traffickers are not bringing their children, but bringing children they've kidnapped or taken and posing as their parents. And I think weeding those situations out is absolutely something people at the border should be doing, and of course not keeping them together if you find that that's the case. But at the same time, there's all these stories, as you're pointing out too, where it's very clear that this is a parent-child relationship and they're also being separated. And I think the longer term solution of how you bring it together is deferring to claims that these are parents, not people posing as parents, and only acting otherwise under clear guidance. But I think it really just points to, if you want a less cruel option, you need some other kind of immigration reform. You need some other way of deterring people from coming across the border illegally. And you know, some other people have made suggestions about what other policies would be. But I think what it means is, if you don't want the status quo as it is now, something's got to change, and you have to come up with a policy that works other than this current deterrence measure.
And this issue isn't necessarily new from what I understand. I mean, I know President Trump made it one of his signature lines on the campaign about building the wall, but President Obama and President Bush both had to wrestle with this issue as well, did they not?
They did. And here's the difference. The Trump administration has used this tactic more extensively than in the past. But when there was the problem in 2014 of a lot of children coming across the border unaccompanied, the Obama administration had to take on a more modest level similar steps. And I think it's legitimate that people are saying, why weren't people as frustrated, or why weren't journalists pointing out that it was happening then? At the same time, it is being done to in a much more systematic, extensive way now than it was then. So I think that's why you do have some more attention paid to it as well. So this is not an old, this is not a new problem, but is a problem that has been heightened by the change in how immigration is trying to be deterred by this administration.
That's Dr. Adam Carrington, professor of politics and constitutional concerns at Hillsdale College. We're going to take a short break. Adam, when we come back, let's talk a little bit about this Inspector General report that came out about the Clinton investigation in 2016. We'll be right back with you. Just about 13 minutes before the top of the hour, this is Faith Radio Mornings, and I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined this morning by Adam Carrington of Hillsdale College, talking about politics, constitution. And Adam, there are some headlines that came out late last week as well. The Inspector General report that had been in process for quite some time, just investigating the FBI's handling of the 2016 Clinton situation with the server. And we know all the details about that. Interesting conclusions out of that. It felt a little mixed message, where on one hand of it, you have some of these FBI texts claiming that they'll stop President Trump, or for candidate Trump, from becoming president at that time, and but then also concluding that there wasn't partisanship, or there wasn't some sort of bias that existed. So how did you read these headlines as they came out?
Yeah, and there's a lot, and the report's over 500 pages. So I was a little skeptical when things first came out about how definitive some people's interpretations were of them. I said, you read a lot faster than me, was my first thought. that said, I think it certainly shows that there are good FBI agents who played this straight, who were trying to do their best to not be partisan, to not be to follow the book. But it also shows that there were several FBI agents, and that director of the FBI, James Comey, who some of them acted on a bias that seemed to be pretty pro-Clinton, or at least have a bias that was pretty pro-Clinton and pretty anti-candidate, then-candidate Trump, and at the same time a sort of institutional self-protection, where when things were done wrongly, the FBI sort of circled the wagons and tried to cover up rather than deal with the matter in an ethical way. And I think what it shows is a lot of what a lot of people were worried about with the handling of the Hillary Clinton issue, that it was not done in a transparent, clear, or ethical way by a number of parts of the FBI. And that's where it becomes kind of hard it's hard to prove that someone definitively did something from bias. And the report said that ultimately they didn't think that was the case. It's quite possible to come to a different conclusion based on the same set of facts that the report came out, that there was bias in Clinton's favor, and that could very well have affected some people in the FBI's decision-making.
And to your point, I mean, it's 500 pages, and you didn't check that out at the rest stop at the Kentucky border there, from what I understand.
No, I know. If I could read that fast, I would make a lot of money some way.
And it does speak to sort of trying to get ahead of the spin and getting ahead of the narrative, right, that you can argue either side of it. And it seems like, at least on some level in the political sphere, that people are more interested in controlling the narrative than really getting down to the facts of the situation.
Absolutely. That is a bigger problem, where immediately both sides were trying to spin this a certain way. And I think what's interesting is that ultimately I think all of this helped President Trump, even though there were a number of people in the FBI who were hoping it would not. The way they handled this situation, I think, only accentuated his argument that there's some deep rot and problematic corruption within parts of our government. And I think waiting and what's interesting is They did that to try to help the what they thought was going to be President Clinton. At the same time, they didn't say anything about the Russia investigation. What's very interesting is those conducting that investigation said nothing. Nothing came out that was an investigation that was ongoing. So I think both of those things together ended up interestingly helping President Trump get elected, even though some people that were behind those decisions were not wanting it. But I think your larger point about getting ahead of the spin, people need to take time to try to cipher these issues out. And I think that cooler heads will prevail later, but right now the hot takes are what's ruling.
Talking with Adam Carrington of Hillsdale and going through some of the main headlines of this past week. And another thing that caught our attention here is that on Friday, President Trump finalized some of the tariffs on China that had been in conversation for quite some time and levied $34 billion, another $16 billion now into the conversation. And I think a lot of people felt like it was just bluster, this tariff conversation. But here we are in sort of a new economic world. What happened in this? Where do we go in the future with some of this trade war stuff?
Yeah, I think we're finally going to get a something of an answer to the question of what is the best trade policy for the United States. And the argument has been between people who say free trade creates jobs, it helps wages, it is overall good for the American economy, versus those that say no, protecting certain industries helps the most vulnerable workers and builds up American industry. And when the president was sort of blustering on this, as you put it, you really couldn't get a definitive answer to that. It was a lot of he said, she said on hypotheticals. This is really going to be an important point. And I think, you know, Americans are not experts on trade policy. I'm not an expert on trade policy. So I think politically the thing to keep in mind is how does the economy do over the next year or two? Right now, the story is the economy is doing well, and the simple answer that a lot of Americans hold on to is President Trump's the tax cut Republicans and President Trump passed. It's sort of a nice, simple narrative. Tax cuts have led to prosperity, however true that is. What if there's an economic downturn? What if we do have a downturn in the economy, and now there is a pretty simple answer that critics of the president can put forward, and that's the tariffs. So if the economy is still churning along in a year or two, he can probably claim that his policy was vindicated. If we see a downturn, then you have a ready-made claim against him, whether true or not. So the politics of that, I think, are pretty interesting in addition to the economics.
And Adam, we have just about a minute left here, but you made a point relative to that yes, the economy is humming along now. But even with the economy doing as well as it is, you're noting that people are really not all that happy in America in spite of the improving economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in the wake of two very prominent famous persons, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, taking their own lives, people have noticed how high the suicide rate is now. And I think what it shows is not that people don't need jobs, not that the economy shouldn't be something we focus on and want to be doing well, but that there's more to human happiness than the money you make or the job you have. And a lot of people are deeply unsatisfied with their lives beyond that. And I think that we really need to start asking not just financial capital questions, but social capital questions of what's happened to our communities, what's happened to our internal psychology, and ask those bigger questions about how humans find fulfillment beyond just the economic measures.
It's Adam Carrington helping us sort through these headlines. Adam, any plans for the summer? Are you off as a prof here? Do you get a little downtime?
I do, and working on academic projects, some writing projects. So hopefully there'll be some good results out of that, a book and something else. But we'll see. I'm sure you know from working on these things that things never quite go on the timetable you set up.
I know nothing of what you're talking about, Adam. Hey, thanks for joining us again this morning. As always, look forward to chatting with you again next week and enjoy the rest of the week. That's Adam Carrington. We'll take a short break and wrap up our first hour. Be strong in the Lord and never give up hope. Great first hour with Jonathan McKee and Adam Carrington. And you know, Matt, the World Cup is happening right now. I know you're a big follower of soccer, right?
Yes.
And there was a headline that came out of Mexico, a huge upset between Mexico and Germany. Of course, Germany is the defending champions of the World Cup, and Mexico beat them in sort of stunning fashion, 1-0 yesterday. And the celebration in Mexico City was so extreme, as these people were jumping up and down in the streets watching the video feeds, that it actually set off two of the city's earthquake sensors and it registered on the Richter scale.
That's crazy. I can't imagine it being that loud and that much, you know, just jostling of the earth in a certain area to just cause it to start shaking.
It's pretty exciting. The fact that we can help create a little bit of a, sort of a natural phenomenon like that if we just jump up and down. And now you know some people in Mexico. You actually had a conversation with somebody after the win, right?
Yeah, he's from Monterrey, Mexico, and so he's just a friend of ours that lives in our neighborhood. He's come up here and lives and is in the community and part of our church, and it is a fun time just to be able to banter back and forth about different soccer matches that as we know each other and talk and give each other a hard time. But he was just ecstatic about the fact that they were able to pull off that upset yesterday.
Yeah, it's fun to watch the fans. I know of no other sport where people cry as often as they cry. And so, I mean, one goal can elicit just these profound emotions. People begin to weep. They wave their flags. They begin to hug each other. And it's this just unbridled joy. Logan always likes to point out that in basketball, it doesn't happen. If you get 2 points, you're just going to get 2 points again in about another 30 seconds. But these goals and the nationalism and the pride, it's pretty fun to watch.
And I think you can have that more when it is something that translates that worldwide, that everybody plays. I mean, basketball is starting to get there. Baseball is somewhat there in Japan and throughout the Caribbean, but there's nothing quite like the way that the world participates in this sport.
Yeah, it seems like even more than the Olympics these days, the World Cup is that sort of seminal event that brings the world together. We get to see all of these cultures and all these countries, and it's really fun just to sit back and see the differences. I enjoyed watching Iceland play, and they had sort of an upset. We saw Switzerland beat the Brazilians as well. It's been really fun to watch the world come together. All right, we'll head to the top of our hour break, and when we come back in the second hour, we'll be joined by Ron Hutchcraft.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.